And now, it's time for the Talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, good morning, and you're very welcome along to Thursday's 9 till noon show. It's the 10th of April, and it's just approaching 4 minutes past nine, and you're very welcome along to the show, and it's a busy one as always. We've got our usual mix of keeping you across all the big stories affecting us here in the Northwest region, and that can be local stories, national stories, or international stories too, can have an impact on us. And we've got loads of guests joining us on the programme, and you can see most of the show, all of our guests for that matter, on our social medias if you want to watch the show. If you're at home or work from home or work in the home, you can watch us on YouTube on your smart TV or your Fire Stick. Just open the YouTube app and type in Highland Radio Ireland. We're on Facebook, Highland Radio News, Sport, and Obituary Notices, and on the Highland Hub page, and we're on the X platform as well at Highland Radio Ireland, is it? I don't know. It's that long since I created that X account. Twitter at the time, I can't remember. 086 60 25000, WhatsApps and texts, 0749125 to give us a call. If you want to email, it's comments@highlandradio.com. The Tyrconnell Tribune out this morning. Residents in Dunfanaghy say they are outraged that visitors brazenly parked in the village centre, taking up three spaces, including one disabled parking spot this week. The vehicle was parked in the market square across a number of parking spots located outside the social security offices on Monday night from around 8 p.m. through until Tuesday morning. Concerns have also been raised that areas such as the piers in the village and Port na Blare are also becoming overrun with camper vans that often impede local fishermen from accessing their boats. A local resident, Monty Alcorn, said he's fished out of Port na Blare for many years and the level of parking on the pier has gotten out of hand, with little consideration given to the fishermen who have to land their catches, launch and recover their boats or store equipment. And There is no parking available either. And, you know, Dunfanaghy's like many of our towns and villages across the country, the county, they can be hotspots for tourists. And it's fantastic because they bring money in. But you need to respect where you're pulling in, where you're parking. There is an image actually on the front of the paper of this, bus, English Reg, UK Reg bus. It is across those three parking spaces. You really don't care if you do that, if you park like that. But we aren't even in the summer season yet. And I always think, and I don't know what the level of signage is like around Dunfanaghy, because I don't have a camper van, so I don't be looking forward for it. But I think, you know, good signage is a good start in any town or village, especially coming into the tourism season, that people know where to go. A note, actually, funny you should say that. I should say that, sorry. I was down on the beach in Downings there the other day, and there were cars on the side of the pillars or the bollards where it's for people only. There's no cars allowed on that side. And someone said to me, that's a disgrace, why are they parked there? You know, that's for families, blah, blah, blah. But there's no sign. The sign has been taken down. It hasn't been put up. I don't know what the story is. There's no sign advising those people who are from outside the area that you can't park there. And you would not know unless there was a sign. So I think heading into the summer season, signage, vital. And then if people continue to flout the local laws or the signage, then we can get angry and get tough. The Derry People Donegal News this morning. Households across West Donegal are grappling with significant challenges due to ongoing water shortages, with some residents and farmers left without access to water for several days. Among those severely impacted is Katie Coyle from Falcarra. She runs Care and Capal, an equine assisted service for those with additional and emotional needs. While most of her horses stay at their premises by the beach, a few are kept on her own farm, which has been without water for the past 2 days. Ms. Coyle is deeply concerned for the well-being of her animals, explaining that each horse requires at least 15 litres of water daily, and even more in the current heat wave. Caroline, did you say that water is beginning to return? We're not sure, is it? Because there were some concerns yesterday in that area and some questions as to why the water supply was switched off. Two things we're looking to get some clarity on. But I've been hearing this morning that water may be returning to some of those parts. We'll get confirmation of that over the course of the next wee while and bring that to you. The Derry News is lead this morning. Underinvestment in Derry's sewerage system, stalling house building. Build Homes NI, a group representing some of Northern Ireland's largest house builders, has said that Derry housing crisis will continue due to chronic underinvestment in the city's sewage system. This is a problem we're seeing right across the country. You can set all the targets in the world for house construction and building, but if you don't have services like sewage, water, power, you can't build the houses, and it's a problem in Derry. House building in Derry and Strabane District Council and across Northern Ireland have fallen in historically low levels because of a lack of capacity in wastewater infrastructure. The group was responding to a consultation published by the Department for Infrastructure into its Living with Water programme. On to the Nationals now, and well, he wobbled, didn't he? Donald Trump thought that he could flex his muscles and the world would bow to him, and he's had to, for the most part, do a massive U-turn on his tariffs. This is his Liz Truss moment, I think. The big problem for Donald Trump was the bonds market, which has always been seen, US bonds have always been seen as a safe haven for investments, almost as good as gold. But who owns an awful lot of these bonds? It's the Chinese. And who started to sell them off? Well, the Chinese and others. And that was a serious problem. That raised serious red flags for the US economy. And yesterday, despite him sending out his team early in the morning saying, you know, we'll not back down, stay cool, we're in this for the long haul, this is like an operation, you know, there will be pain, but then there will be gain. He's had to back down. He's had to suspend the majority of his tariffs for 90 days. Will they come in after 90 days? No chance. He and China are obviously in a more significant escalating trade war. But in terms of the rest of the world, now he's saying, you know, it's us versus them almost. So he's put a flat rate 10% right across the world, which is greatly reducing the tariffs that he launched on Liberation Day. And it'll be interesting to see how this pans out. I mean, potentially, if the markets don't settle, if things don't settle, if this Chinese situation doesn't work out well for him, this could be his death knell. I'll read here. The US President Donald Trump announced a 90-day ceasefire in the worsening global trade war last night. But deep uncertainty continues to spook the global economy, financial markets and America's trading partners after the sudden move. After repeatedly insisting there would be no change in his tariff policy, Mr. Trump blinked last night when he dramatically cut tariffs on all countries to 10% for 90 days, except for China, which has been hit with 125% tariffs immediately. After days of massive losses on the stock market since the tariffs were announced last week, the pressure on the Trump administration intensified yesterday with a sell-off of U.S. Treasury bonds, which threatened to increase the cost of U.S. government borrowing and put the country's ability to finance in massive deficits, its massive deficits in doubt. So these bonds are to meet their debt. They run a deficit, a debt deficit. And he had stated that this would bring down the cost of debt. In fact, it had the opposite effect. It increased the cost. And that was a problem because he's heading towards bankrupting a company, a country that has a massive deficit but can't borrow. The trend caused significant disquiet among market analysts who warned of potentially catastrophic consequences for the global financial system if there was a mass sell-off of US Treasury, which some market watchers feared was already underway. After a bullish speech to Republicans in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday evening, Mr. Trump continued to insist he was not for turning and promised that more tariffs on pharmaceuticals would follow. But as markets wobbled again yesterday morning, Mr. Trump made what appeared to be efforts to restore some confidence in a series of social media posts. But the president's exorbitations failed to reassure markets, and as the day went on, there were increasing worries about the bond market, traditionally a safe haven, as I mentioned, for investors in times of turmoil on the markets as the trade was war seemed to get worse. So they were watching. So in the early part of yesterday, and this is how it happens live, in the early part of yesterday, they were trying to reassure the markets, but that didn't work. So then he had to do the big U-turn. But this is where us normal people need to make sure we know what's going on. Donald Trump would have known immediately that as soon as he announced this 90-day freeze, that the stock markets would go up, and they went up significantly. And the people that have made a fortune off this right now are not you and me, and they're not regular people in America, and they're not worried about things like eggs. These are billionaires. They would he may well have let people know what he was doing. Billionaires go in, buy up the stocks at the low. He announced the 90-day pause. The stocks go through the roof, and people make millions and billions and billions of dollars. I'm not saying that was the plan, but you know, there was talk of that when this whole notion was launched in the first instance. What about teachers? What's life like for a teacher? The Irish Independent and other papers report that almost 9 out of 10 teachers in primary and secondary school are experiencing moderate to high levels of burnout. This according to a new study. The Dublin City University study on teacher occupational well-being in Ireland indicates burnout is a significant issue across the education sector. The initial findings indicated a significant proportion of respondents report moderate to high burnout levels, highlighting the urgent need for intervention and support. The research shows 86% of teachers who responded reported moderate to high level. I don't know how many times they can say moderate to high levels of personal burnout. Who writes this? The research shows 86% of teachers who responded reported moderate to high levels of personal burnout, while a similar figure reported experiencing moderate to high levels of work-related burnout. So, you know, a lot of people think teachers have it handy. That conversation comes up quite a bit, doesn't it? But obviously not, because 9 out of 10 of them have moderate to high burnout. Teachers were asked to record their self-rated mental health over the last year, and 28% of respondents rated it as poor or very poor. So almost 1 in 3 teachers have poor or very poor mental health. 9 out of 10 of them have these high levels of personal burnout. Worrying. AI is good. AI is all right. I mean, I try and use it in day-to-day life, and I find it gets things wrong more than it gets right. And when I say gets wrong things wrong, I don't mean information, but its functionality in helping me with a task. I just find sometimes it's, all the time, I'm not having much fun with it. But anyway, things are improving in that regard, I'm told. But what a lot of us are doing, and I think particularly the new graduates, not me, but new graduates, they're drawing up CVs using AI. And the CV reads and looks fantastic. It's really good at that kind of stuff. And it can be personalised for the individual. But what happens is that, and I've seen this here when we've gone through CVs for jobs here at Highland Radio, the CV is great, and maybe the candidate is great as well, but the CV and the candidate don't match, because, you know, you need a personal touch to a CV. It has to reflect you. It doesn't have to look good and read good just. It has to be about you. And this is causing a problem. Employees have warned over a growing trend of job applications using artificial intelligence to enhance their CVs or even produce them entirely. Global recruitment firm Morgan McKinley says its clients are becoming increasingly concerned over mismatches between the CV content and the candidate's performance. Some are even demonstrating a lack of familiarity with what's written. So they're getting AI to write their CV, but aren't actually reading through it, which is not good. Morgan Stanley Ireland's first quarter report of the new year found AI is reshaping how employers hire and evaluate talent. It said reports of mismatches between CV content and candidate performance are becoming more common, placing greater pressure on screening processes and the assessment of authenticity. Get help with your CV. Don't just use AI. And, you know, it doesn't have to be really long. It doesn't have to be 10 pages. Just the facts and a bit about yourself. That's really what's critical, isn't it? The Irish Farmers Journal, Ireland's export-dependent agriculture and food industry is bracing for the global trade war sparked by US President Donald Trump's tariffs. Irish dairy and tillage are most exposed to the US tariffs through significant butter and whiskey exports. The EU has not imposed retaliatory tariffs on the US bourbon and dairy producers, which will ease concerns in the Irish drinks and dairy industries that they could face tariffs above 20% in a tit-for-tat trade war. Now, this story has been compiled prior to the U-turn by Donald Trump yesterday evening. The Irish Daily Star tells us that TDs and senators were yesterday urged to take immediate action to protect the future of journalism by changing the law. News Brands Ireland, which represents titles like the Irish Daily Star, briefed politicians on threats including outdated defamation laws, unfair use of journalism by digital platforms, and misinformation. It's calling on government to safeguard original journalism from exploitation by AI and tech platforms. It also wants the reform of defamation laws that are among the most restrictive in Europe, and the enforcement of fair copyright practices against digital giants and proper compensation for content. I don't really have much of a view on much of that, except the defamation laws. And, you know, you will often see, and this is a struggle for a show like this, you'll often see that people can say anything on social media, and stories are covered in certain ways on social media. And then, you know, people will tune into this show and go, well, why has he said it like that? Why isn't he naming this? Now, I mean, obviously, you will always have to check the veracity of a story, that it's accurate, that things are correct. But we are very restricted in the media as to what you can say and how you can say it in terms of potentially being sued. And as soon as you are sued, as soon as the process begins, it takes up an awful lot of time and potentially resources. So our laws are outdated. We do see a situation where people are sued for defamation in this country because they know you get big payouts, and not in the likes of America, whereby you have much more freedom to speak. In the Irish Daily Mirror this morning, I read this because his voting history, for the most part, is in this region. I wonder how he would do. Luke Ming Flanagan is thinking of running for president, the lifelong pot smoker and independent MEP. It's interesting they put his pot smoking before his political career. But anyway, he says he'll make a decision in the coming weeks and said he has every chance of winning if he runs. The popular Roscommon politician headed the poll in the Midlands Northwest constituency in last summer's European election. He believes he can be a very strong left-wing candidate for the IRS. I wonder how he would get on. He's confident. As I say, he performs generally quite well in the West and Northwest. Perhaps, maybe. It's another hat that could be in the ring. And finally, I know many of you follow this catfish story. I have no knowledge of it whatsoever, but a school has stopped disciplinary proceedings against a teacher who claimed she was falsely identified as the so-called GEA catfish, in a popular Irish podcast series. Niamh Farrell from Portadown County Armagh, and I think someone actually told me that this is who it was, said allegations she was deceiving people online by pretending to be someone else and luring men in the GEA community into relationships was completely untrue. In March, she obtained a temporary injunction against the school where she works, Colostia Anna in Rathfarnham, Dublin, preventing it from continuing with disciplinary proceedings against her. Her senior counsel, Conor Power, told the High Court the case had been resolved as the school had agreed to stop the disciplinary process. The allegations arose from a number of episodes of a podcast by the two Johnnies. Now, there were pictures going around of someone on a phone. I wonder, was that her? The reason I read that is because, you know, a lie travels quicker than the truth, or something along those lines. So just in case, maybe it's clarified her position for any of you listening out there. Okay, we'll be back very shortly. Stay where you are. Just to let you know, tomorrow we are heading west to Gweedore. We're going to be in Irish Pressings. It's a market leader in the design and manufacturing of tooling, metal stampings, welding assemblies, projection welding, precision machining and prototyping services. They are celebrating their 20th birthday. And to help them celebrate, the 9 till noon show will be live from it in Gweedore this Friday, the 11th of April, of course, that is tomorrow. And we will have the show as usual, our Friday panel and all that kind of stuff. But we'll be chatting to some people from that company, of course, and others from the region. So looking forward to that. Tune into that if you can. Right, we're going to be talking about the Ulster University. It's hosting an Ulster Talks. It's a free event open to the public this Saturday at 10:30 a.m. in On Green and Hotel. I have a number of guests joining me in relation to this. I'll go to you first, Professor Paul Dunlop. And before we sort of get into the nuts and bolts of what's coming up on Saturday, just your reaction to the wording and the contents of the documentation revealed as part of the public consultation on IS465. Have you any encouragement or concerns?
Well, it's first of all, I'm glad that it's finally out, because it took quite a while for it to happen. I mean, part of that was it took took time for us to do the research that fed into that. And there was another company called RSK who did work independent of us on the same samples. So we weren't allowed to look at their results either. So that was sort of done blind, if you like. So that work took a long time. So I'm glad that it's finally out. I think when you look at it, first of all, there's a massive shift away from looking at this mica freeze thaw issue that was wrong, and it's now mainly looking at internal sulfate attack, looking at total sulfur levels and pyrrhotite. So it's really, really good that that's been acknowledged.
But mica freeze thaw is still in there. Have still you any there, concerns yeah, about yeah. that?
Yeah, yeah. So they've left things in behind that I'm a bit concerned about, and I'm not entirely sure why it's there, other than some work that was done by Petrolab had found a number of properties. I think there was around 39 properties that they identified as part of their the testing on the scheme that had a type of aggregate called Willard micaceous quartzite that had no iron sulfides, but still was cracking, was sort of present on some of the homes. So I don't really know much more about it unless it's been kept behind for cases like that. One of the other concerns that I have is that the total sulfur level that they've set for the protocol is set at 0.3. And I think that that's too high for properties in Donegal, because the standard for aggregates is called EN12620, sets the total sulfur level at 0.1 if there's pyrrhotite in the aggregate. And if you add another additional 0.1 from cement paste, because sulfur comes from cement paste, that would bring it to 0.2. So I'm not sure why they've set it at 0.3. That could be a problem for some homes that are clipping just below that.
What is in relation to that? How is this a fully independent process? Is it because, you know, with some of those markers that you talk of there, if say for instance you were in control of the state's finances and you were trying to sort of limit the scope of a scheme, the higher that number potentially, the better, if you know what I mean. So, but this is independent, isn't it? And we can be assured that it will be the science that's followed here and not any measures to sort of, as I say, trying to limit liability or for.
Well, I hope that it's following science. It's meant to. I mean, this is a standard that should be based on the highest quality of science that's available. And we certainly fed that into them. And we had very clear instructions from our view of what the science showed. And people can download that from the Geological Survey of Ireland's website. We asked very clearly that the science has to be open so the public can see what has been said. Now, a lot of it's quite technical and maybe it's past most people's understanding, but there was a couple, I think it was a two-page summary of results that we put in, and we clearly stated in that there's no evidence at all that mica causes freeze-thaw degradation, or that the concrete blocks in Donegal are suffering from freeze-thaw. So why that is kept in the standard has got nothing to do with the advice that we give them. We weren't asked to set a level of total sulfur in those testing protocols, but we did say that it was really clear that the what's causing it is internal sulfate attack. So why it's been set at 0.3 is something that the NSAI committee would have to come on and explain, really. But for me, I don't think that we should have a standard that is recommending a total sulfur level that basically breaches EU regulations, because that effectively what it does, you know. So going back to the standard for aggregates, EN12620, it sets it at 0.1. The cement paste would, from a sort of standard concrete block, would release about another 0.1. So when you're testing concrete blocks, you've got to factor that in. So that would mean basically to be compliant, the total sulfur reading would need to be 0.2. So why they've went another 0.1 means that it can only be coming from the aggregates. Mm. So that there is something that would need to come out in this public consultation.
And just last question in relation to that, and pardon my ignorance in how I approach this. I don't know the science or the tech side of it, but just foundations. A lot of people are holding off wondering if foundations might be included. Do you have any concern or comment that we could have a situation whereby, you know, your foundations could be found to have similar levels to blocks, but because it's formed differently and sits differently, that it might be less vulnerable to deterioration. Is there going to be a grey area there, or do you think there might be clarity on whether, you know, we'll have a standard for foundations as well, and whether or not we'll see foundations included in any future designs of this scheme?
Well, a massive swing in this revised standard is they've now included testing for foundations. Now, that was completely excluded before, and you'll know yourself that there's, from campaigners for the last few years, people have been saying, no, you must include the foundations. So, I mean, they're now being tested in this new protocol. So that's a very big win, that I think. I think the standard for removal has been set higher than the concrete blocks. And that is based on the research that we did and RSK did. And we basically found that there was a lower risk of failure than the concrete blocks. But for our team, and I can only speak on behalf of ours, we were very clear that there's a risk there, and we couldn't quantify that risk in terms of its long term.
But that does need to be quantified in terms of mortgaging, borrowing, insurance. Yeah. We don't know how those markets might treat a brand new house built on, even though we don't know potentially when they might fail, but foundations that could fail.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I mean, I had a look at RSK's work because we hadn't seen that. That was only made available last week on the Geological Survey and his webpage, so people can have a look through that. So they also found sort of fairly similar things to us, that, you know, that there's pyrrhotite there, that it's oxidized, and there's some byproducts for internal sulfate attack in the concrete. So they're saying that there's a risk. I see that the standard has sort of, in the revised standard, they're talking about that the I think it was RSK said this too, that the foundation concrete goes beyond the 50 years life, sort of severable life of these concrete foundations that would be for a typical home. My opinion would have been, and we said this at meetings, you know, that it's wrong to pass the full burden of responsibility back on the families again. I mean, if we're in a situation where it's acknowledged that internal sulfate attack is now the reason, and that the concrete blocks can't be retained in the home, so effectively these homes are coming down and are getting demolished, then why would you keep concrete that's potentially going to not last the life of the new house? So it's, for me, I just think it's wrong to pass the full burden responsibility, the full burden of responsibility back on the families again, and it's just better to remove them. And then you build sustainable homes in areas that are defective.
Okay, thanks for that, Paul. We're going to hear more from Paul. Dr. Eileen Doherty's joining us, and Joe Morgan, the EU campaigner, as part of this wider campaign. We're going to hear from all of them in the context of this this Ulster Talks event taking place on Saturday after these. So are you impacted or interested in finding out more about more information on the defective concrete crisis? If so, the Ulster University is hosting that Ulster Talks. It's a free event open to the public this Saturday, the morning, 10:30 a.m. in On Green and Hotel Burt. And it's going to have a number of key local, national and international stakeholders in attendance. We heard from Professor Paul Dunlop, and we'll hear more from him in a moment. But I want to say good morning to Eileen Doherty, who is a lecturer in digital transformation at Ulster University. Good morning, Eileen. Thanks for your time. Eileen's nipped out for a sec. I'll say good morning to Joe Morgan, who's an EU campaigner. Hi, Joe.
Hey, Greg, how are you?
Good, good, good. Right, Joe, so you've a big piece of work in this the whole wider scheme of things. What are you going to be talking about, Joe?
So, Greg, the session that I'm going to be involved with MEP Luckmunk Flanagan is really just to recount the EU thread of the campaign. And then given that this is an Ulster University-hosted event with an academic theme, we thought we'd go at that in a case study format, if we like. So myself and Luke are basically just going to chat through what has actually now become the last 4 years. So we started the thread of the campaign when Luke approached Eileen and Anne Owens in Dublin at the first protest. And it's still ongoing today. So it's a 4-year journey, and we just thought we'd look back, reflect on it, and pull out some of the key success factors, if you like, that got us to a point where we were successful in getting the EU Commission to infringe Ireland. And hopefully, in that regard, we will be successful in enhancing what is currently very questionable market surveillance practice for the construction industry in Ireland.
Yeah, because this is bigger, and the work that you're undertaking in Europe is bigger than this crisis, as big as that is. This is about ensuring situations like this cannot arise again, not just here in Donegal, not just here in Ireland either. Would that be fair to say?
Absolutely, Greg. I mean, I often remember back to the presentation that myself and Anne made to the Petitions Committee quite some time ago. I think it was December 2021 now. And we were specifically asked them that what we wanted them to do was to mandate legislative change in Ireland that would ensure, I think my words were, my kids and the kids of families in Donegal and Mayo were not back in the Parliament in 15, 20 years explaining to them that their houses were crumbling down around them. So that is the primary objective. We're not seeing the political will here in Ireland to enhance market surveillance of the construction industry. And look, there's evidence out there that it is ongoing. You know, even Petrolab has published evidence of excessive minerals in excess of EU regulation in new builds as recently as last year. So that has to change, be caught.
One thing that, and maybe it's happening, I don't know, and again, a pardon for my ignorance, that surely the biggest drivers of this would be the product manufacturers. That they would be the ones saying, I mean, some companies must have seen a fallout, a lack of trust in their products. Surely they should be clamouring for clarity in this area, or maybe they are.
Yeah, and, you know, I can't say categorically, Greg, whether they are or they not, but to your point, I would suspect that they are making efforts to improve what has been produced. However,
Need a standard, sort of, because of a trust issue, they need a state standard so people will have faith in the work that they say that they're doing, so
yeah,
that
absolutely.
They can sell more of their products.
There are very clear guidelines in terms of the constitution of aggregate that goes into these concrete blocks. And as I said, Petrolab has published their own findings recently that states that there are excessive levels per EU regulation of deleterious minerals in blocks in new builds. And the fact that that's continuing after 15, 20 years of knowledge of this crisis, it's inexcusable.
Dr. Eileen Doherty is one of the most familiar voices right from the very beginning of this entire campaign. She's a lecturer in digital transformation at Ulster University. Eileen, a significant event this Saturday. What's your focus going to be?
Thank you very much for having me.
Just one second, Eileen. I'll tell you what I might do. I'm going to switch off your video in the hope that it improves the audio side of things.
We're looking forward to the conference.
No, I'm afraid Eileen's relying on 5G, which is a bit of an issue. Professor Paul, sorry, I was going over your views on the ongoing public consultation. Your focus for Saturday will be much of what we've talked of.
Yeah, more or less that. I mean, a lot of the work that we did for the last 2 years was behind closed doors. That's just the way the process worked with NSEI. We weren't really able to share much of that work with the public. We did publish research papers, as you know, in cement and concrete research. So that was the only way that we could allow the public to see what the results were showing. So what we thought we would do in this session would be to bring most of the team together back to Donegal again and explain what we found. So people are really, really clear from a scientific point of view of what the research in our Ulster University Research Consortium found. Now, in that consortium, there was EMPA, Switzerland, University of Connecticut, Laval University, Concrete Testing Research and Testing Labs in the States, and our own university, Ulster University, working really hard for over a year analysing this concrete to the highest level possible with the latest scientific techniques to try and understand why the concrete had failed. And we want to now bring that group together and share with the general public those research findings in an understandable way. So not too technical, but just bring people along and let them understand what we did. We're also bringing Geological Survey of Ireland, who were sort of in the sort of space of working between us and the NSAI to try and explain how the research then informed the policy, which is basically IS 465 and this, and hopefully the scheme down the line. And then we also have Pierre-Luc Fateau from Laval University coming across to explain how this concrete is actually changing because of internal sulfate attack. You know, everyone for the last 10 years has been told that our houses are falling apart because of mica. We now know what's causing this, and we know that this process causes the concrete to basically grow and expand and crack and fall apart. And we've had a house that's been rigged up and monitored for over a year. And we want to sort of show some of the results of that, to sort of, because it's really important now to get an idea of how long these houses will last that are undergoing. Then we have a round table discussion with all our scientists who are part of the group, Professor Benoit Fournier. And we're also bringing in a local TD, Borat McLaughlin, to talk about the policy end of this. You know, how will this all feed into the scheme? Because ultimately, this will change legislation, particularly around things like foundations and things like the way the whole scheme works. So it's trying to explore that. So at the end of our session, we're hoping that people will have an idea of what is not causing this problem, what is causing this problem, and they may have a better understanding of how they can engage with the public consultation process.
And the monitoring of this property you talk of, does that back up the move away from freeze-thaw being part of this problem?
It does, because it shows the concrete's degrading throughout the seasons.
It's not triggers but at particular times.
Apart from that, all the microscope work that we did, the chemical analysis that we did, all independently shows that mica is not causing this problem.
All right, Joe, the one thing, Joe Morgan, the one thing we can't check with, taking a core sample, because we can't do it to humans, is the devastating impact this is having on people. Those directly affected by this certainly know exactly what I'm talking about here. Those who aren't maybe don't get a full sense of how devastating this can be. Dr. Karen Kirby, a senior lecturer and chartered practitioner in psychology, social school of psychology, Ulster University, will be there. It's important, isn't it, Joe, that we hear that side of things?
Yeah, absolutely, Greg. And you know, you make a good point. I think, like many crises, the people are involved, and you know, those that aren't impacted directly or slightly indirectly, I think it's difficult to ask them or even to expect them to understand the true impact that it has on people's well-being, mental health, etc. We talk about that quite a bit. So, you know, Dr. Karen Kirby has led out on a quite in-depth study of the mental health impacts across a fairly significant swath of impacted homeowners. So some of that has been made in the public domain, but I know from talking to Dr. Kirby that there are additional insights that herself and the PhD students that's done the work on the research, they are going to be publishing new, currently unpublished findings as well. So, yeah, look, I think I know, Paul knows, Eileen would know, and all your listeners out there that are directly impacted, It's quite a gunk when you find out initially that your home is made from defective concrete, but the journey that you need to go on subsequent to that to get to a point where you know you're back in a home that you can feel is safe and is shelter for you and your family, that's quite a stressful.
And it's like any life shock we get, be it a medical diagnosis or whatever it might be, we all handle it differently. Some of us do it quietly, some of us do it loudly, some of us internalize, some of us externalize. You know, it's complex. And how does this affect 8-year-olds, 16-year-olds, 82-year-olds? You know, there's so many different people, different ages, that this has a devastating impact. Just simply getting that news, it is almost like sitting in front of a consultant. Did you want to come in on that, Paul?
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right. And Oisin Keenan, the PhD student who's working under Ciaran, has done such an excellent job of trying to quantify that, because our lived experience of this is that this is a very traumatic event to happen to you. But the dragged out nature of trying to get through the scheme and get onto the scheme and get to move on with your life and dealing with it on a daily basis and then living in a community with everyone else dealing with it as well too, it's clear that that there's a problem. The significant thing that's happened with the research is that it's now quantified and it's now going through the peer review process. And I think that so rather than us basically being seen as complaining and moaning about it, and sort of this is actually a serious independent scientific study that quantifies the impacts of this, you know. And it's the same as any other crisis or any thing. I mean, you would hope that the government again would step up and do something about that. Mm-hmm. And we would argue that it's not good enough just to put in mental health services, which are important. The main problem of the suffering and is the delayed nature of the scheme and getting through that. That's what's causing the problem. Get people out of the situation and that solves it.
Yeah, and I'm not being insensitive to the loss of life or anything, but the way I try and think of this is if, you know, when there's news coverage of families returning to worn, torn areas. You know, obviously they have a far more it's far more devastating visually, but that's when you return to that property or you return to that property or you're told that it's crumbling. We're in the same space. That's treated as a sort of a cause and effect crisis. Whereas here, sometimes people are characterized as being dramatic, just making noise for the fun of it, or greedy. It's crazy,
that's right.
Isn't it?
I mean, so that's why it's been important to do this psychological study, you know, independent, very rigorous, the best sort of statistical measures, a good population size, and then put it out for peer review to let the peers review the paper, let them criticize it and come back. Because once that's accepted and published, then that puts a line in the sand in terms of this is actually the real impact of this crisis for families and how people are feeling.
All right, Professor. Yes, of course, Joe. Please do.
One last point, just in terms of what you brought up there, because I thought it was very important. So, you spoke to the very diverse nature and the fact this, you know, this crisis impacts a wide breadth of people in terms of, you know, their age, their socioeconomic background, their financial status, etc. And I think that's to the core of the issues that we're currently seeing with the scheme, and some of the statistics that Eileen will be presenting on Saturday will speak to this in a little bit more detail. But there's a very small number of houses that have been remediated to date. There are a few hundred, I think, that maybe are in the process of remediation. That leaves the vast majority of people still either not started or maybe in very early stages of administration and haven't gone through this journey yet. The rationale for that is because of the situation that people find themselves in terms of their own personal circumstance. And the scheme is one size fits all. It doesn't deviate from a central thread to look at the needs of the very diverse community that's impacted. And I think that's fundamentally wrong. Like, if you look at an example as elderly, you cannot. I know of one elderly couple. I think the lady in question is the gentleman in question is in his 90s and the lady is in her late 80s, and they're expected to do this on their own with no additional supports from government to get them through the scheme. And I think that's it's disgusting, to be quite frank.
Right, and you can sort of reflect on some leaked language from attorney generals or what have you, and maybe point to the fact that this is not necessarily an accident sometimes. But listen, we've only scratched the surface, but thank you for helping us do that. Joe Morgan, EU campaigner, Professor Paul Dunlop, thank you very much indeed. I do appreciate your time. We were hoping to hear from Dr. Eileen Doherty, lecturer in digital transformation at Ulster University, but unfortunately the line just was not up to scratch. And Dr. Karen Kirby will also be speaking, as we've just mentioned, as to the sort of psychological impact of that. That's all taking place at the wonderful setting of On Green on Hotel. It's this Saturday morning at 10:30. And obviously this is a very complex issue, but all the information is going to be delivered in a very understandable way. So if you are impacted or indeed interested in finding out more about the defective concrete crisis, the place to be is On Green and Hotel Burt, Saturday morning, 10:30. Many of you would have heard of the sad situation which left 84-year-old Eddie from Trenta without a home and all of his belongings and his 16-year-old dog. An awful shock to Eddie. All of his belongings and his pet lost in a fire. Francis Neely is his neighbour and joins us on the programme now. Frances, thanks for your time.
Hi, good morning. How are you this morning?
I am good. And obviously a terrible situation for Eddie, and very much felt in the community as well, given his popularity and what he's lost.
Yeah, you've definitely hit the nail on the head there. He's just an absolute gentleman. Like, Eddie's an 84-year-old gentleman, and he's been living in the area all his life. He's grew up just a quiet, simple life. He keeps himself to himself. And it's just a huge shock to everyone.
He's being currently looked after by his neighbours. The council, I understand, is seeking emergency accommodation. But at 84, he's going to have to start from scratch. And it's going to be very difficult without the public support, Frances.
Definitely. That's what we're hoping for, that we'll get as much support as we can, especially financially at the moment. He was left with literally nothing. We arrived at the scene literally within minutes, and we were greeted by Eddie, thankfully alive, but literally with just the clothes on his back. He didn't even have a pair of shoes on, bless him. And basically he's lost everything, absolutely everything, including the loss of his beloved dog, Glenn, which was an absolute tragedy.
And I get the feeling that, you know, Eddie has contributed so much to others in the community, and now it's time to sort of give back and help him.
Exactly, exactly. He's one of those guys that's there regardless of what's going on. He's there to support. So now it's time for everyone around to support. And even so far, the support has been immense. Even on that night of the fire, I think he was overwhelmed by the turnout of neighbours, especially when the word had got out that there was a fire in our area, and when they came up and realised it was Eddie, the support has been immense, and hopefully will just grow and grow more, especially on the financial side to set him back up again, as he is left with literally nothing.
Yeah, that's shocking. And it's, as you say, you know, it's to get him back onto his feet, to give him the space to do that. So how can people help? And there's no amount too small here. We know things are tight for many, many people, but a lot of little donations will really make a difference. How can people support Eddie and support the community in supporting him?
Yes, well, my daughter Lucinda has actually set up a GoFundMe page. Mm-hmm. So if you do go on there, you can give as much. Whatever you want. Things are tight at the moment. But, you know, if you forego a coffee or a sandwich and put that money towards helping Eddie to somewhat a more comfortable future, he's been a kind and contributing person within our community, and now it's our turn just to give any little thing. Mm-hmm. Any small amount will be greatly appreciated.
Yeah, and something like this can be a big shock for anyone at any age, but particularly someone in their mid-80s. So hopefully the community support and the general public generosity might be enough to give him a wee lift to get himself back together and look towards the future.
Oh.
Do you know what people search for on GoFundMe? We'll link it on our socials, but Frances, do you know that, is there an easy way to find the link if people wish to donate?
Well, usually the best way there at the moment is that they've been putting in on the GoFundMe. It's the support for Eddie after
support
losing
Eddie.
I'm just trying to.
Okay. Do you know
support for Eddie.
For Eddie. Okay, and there'll be a blurb there, so you know it's about Eddie from Trenta. We'll share that on our socials as well. As you say, maybe just forgo one coffee and donate it and help get this. This gentleman back on his feet. Thanks, Frances. I appreciate it. Fair play to you and fair play to your daughter, Lucinda, you said, was it?
Lucinda, yes. Yeah. Lucinda had actually initially saw the fire from driving through Churchill, okay. And she alerted ourselves. And when we arrived, thankfully, within minutes, everyone was there to show their support.
Nice.
It was just very unfortunate that Glenn, his beloved dog, unfortunately didn't make it.
It's traumatic for Eddie, but it's traumatic for everyone. Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much indeed. Take care of yourself. We'll link that on our socials. We'll be back with more on the program after a quick break for the news and obituary notices.